This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Looking for a new podcast with a Connecticut connection? We'll learn about a crime podcast produced by New London's newspaper, The Day. Reporter Karen Florin and Carlos Virgen will join us to talk about the podcast called Case Unsolved. That's later. Also, Connecticut state parks are busy already with the start of summer just a couple of weeks away, but not all of the state parks are open. We'll get an update on recovery efforts inside Sleeping Giant State Park. We'll also hear from Hamden's mayor. Now, Sleeping Giant closed after severe storms in May caused widespread damage in the park and also in the town. First, last week, a pair of high-profile deaths shocked many. Designer Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, TV host, chef, and author, have both died by suicide. Have you lost someone to suicide? Do you think more needs to be done to combat stigma surrounding suicide? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now, the deaths of Spade and Bourdain come as the federal government has released new numbers on suicides in the U.S., and the trends are not looking good. Joining us now for more is Dr. Jill Harkavy-Friedman. She's Vice President of Research at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. She's also a clinician. Dr. Harkavy-Friedman, welcome to the show.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you for having me.
Before we begin, I do want to mention, and we've done shows on this in the past, there is a national suicide prevention hotline. That number is 1-800-273-TALK. There's a crisis text line. You can text TALK to 741-741. And in Connecticut, you can always call 211. So, Jill, I wanted to dive into this report from the CDC where it's found that suicide rates have increased in nearly every state from 1999 through 2016, up more than 30% in half of the states since 1999. What's your reaction to the numbers?
Well, I think the numbers are a call to action. It's actually been a gradual increase of suicide rate, and really what we want to see is a decrease in suicide rate. So I think it highlights that suicide is a national problem, and unless we do something about it, we are going to keep seeing things climb. But we believe that we can bring that curve down, and we know that suicide can be prevented.
In 2016 alone, 45,000 Americans died by suicide. What are some of the reasons behind this increase from your organization's standpoint, Jill?
Well, we know, first of all, that suicide is complex. There's no one thing that causes it. We know that mental health conditions are often involved, but most people with mental health conditions do not die by suicide. So there are other lifetime factors that contribute as well as recent stress. And it's really important for us to focus on getting access to mental health care, early identification, and limiting access to lethal means. Those are three things we can do right away to try to bring down the rate of suicide.
When we look at the years surveyed again between 1999 through 2016, you know, part of those years was during the recession. When we look at how these numbers can change, how there are cycles, I mean, is that also something when we look at when the economy dips, people lose their jobs, you see numbers like this spike?
So we do see a mild increase related to things like recessions and unemployment. Again, it's not the recession itself. Most people are not taking their lives. But what happens is that those people who have risk factors may be triggered by losing their job. Also, remember, when you lose your job, you lose your health care sometimes. So that if you have a mental health condition that you're taking care of, and you, or a physical health condition or pain, and you lose those health care, that health care coverage, that could also trigger suicide. So again, many people lost their jobs. I think it was 4.8 million people lost their jobs. Most people, you know, were able to get through it. But those people that have other factors like a history of mental health condition, family history, traumatic brain injury, physical illness, pain, those can make you a little bit more vulnerable when a stress happens. And when you're in that stress, your brain and your system can change so that you're much less flexible and much less able to problem solve and make decisions.
We're emphasizing the numbers, but again, there are people behind these numbers. What do we know about the demographics, Jill, and the people who are dying by suicide in this country? Who are they?
Well, it's interesting. Just to start, we know that suicide cuts across all demographics. There's no demographic untouched. However, if we were to look at where the most suicides occur and for whom, it's mostly for males, middle-aged, white males in particular, but we've seen an increase in middle-aged females as well. That's where the largest increase has been through these past few years.
When we look at the demographics again, so I understand when we look at the number of suicide deaths, 77% were white men?
Yep, 77% were white men, and 51% of suicides are by firearms. And so there are two things we can do with that. One is to reach out to white men and learn more about what is leading them to suicide, and that's why we need things like the National Violent Death Reporting System, where the CDC got its data from. The National Violent Death Reporting System, or NVDRS, collects data from the police records, from the hospital records, and the coroner records. And so that's why their information is a little bit different from what we know from research about suicide. And if you think about it, in the CDC report, most people were not reported to have a mental health condition. And what we know from interviewing family members and friends is that 90% of people who die by suicide have a mental health condition. So that discrepancy is a warning that we need to increase mental health awareness, and we need to increase access to care, health care in general.
On the phone with me is Dr. Jill Harkavy-Friedman, Vice President of Research at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. She's also a clinician as we look at the latest study from the CDC that finds suicide rates in our country. They have risen in nearly every state. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I wanted to go back, Jill. You mentioned that there are also has been a significant increase in the number of middle-aged women who die by suicide. I reference the death of designer Kate Spade last week. When we look at women, what drives them to suicide?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Many things that drive anybody to suicide are the same. And we have been studying people, not women and men, but everybody together. And I think that these data and recent deaths highlight the need to study everybody, but then also break it down by factors like gender and sexual orientation and even unemployment and work. So what we know about women is that more women are dying by suicide than previously, but the culture around being a woman and being in the workforce middle age has changed through the years. I think we need to learn more about that. We also, you know, there's been a lot of work talking about whether or not, for instance, the issue of hormone replacement for menopausal women. We don't know the impact of that. We don't know how to treat depression among women. We don't really know what is driving it yet, but I do believe with research we're going to figure that out.
You've mentioned the importance of research. The federal government, are they doing enough to study the causes behind the suicide rate increasing nationwide? And in terms of when we look at treatment, medication is just one option. Is enough being done to look at alternative treatments so that people can feel comfortable trying different options if they have suicidal ideation?
You know, that's a great question, and it's really a two-part question. One is, what can the government do? And the other is, what do we do to help people who have suicidal behavior? So in terms of the government, suicide prevention research is sorely underfunded. And in fact, at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, we're at our advocacy forum right now in Washington, D.C. And tomorrow, we're going to visit all 535 congressional offices. And one of the things we're requesting is an increase in funding for research. The research dollars are going up to a mere $42 million compared to billions of dollars. Now, we know that when we invest in research, we're able to find life-saving solutions. Now, the other question you raised is, how do you help somebody who is thinking about suicide? And yes, medication is one option, but it's not enough. it can help people to function better. But we actually have been learning about treatments that can help people manage suicidal ideation when it comes up so that they don't act on it. So there's lots to be learned about treatments, but through funding, especially from American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, we have funded the development of several treatments that have been shown, and they're psychotherapies that have been shown to help reduce suicide attempts. And also, we know that they also help change the brain to make the brain more functional. So when someone's thinking about suicide, they don't have to act on it.
Lisa is calling from Thomaston, and you can join the conversation, too, 860-275-7266. Lisa, welcome to the show. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
What's your comment or your question?
Well, I have a question. Our family was personally affected by suicide many years ago. But I'm curious to know, you know, has there been any, you mentioned white men and the majority of those are suicide by gun. Has there been any research into what percentage are, you know, prior military, what percentage also had some sort of drug use? I'd be curious to see what the numbers are on that.
Thank you, Lisa, yes, for your questions. Go ahead, Jill.
Sorry. Well, we are learning. We're working on a system to track prior military history. And so one of the ways is the VA is working with the Department of Defense to try and have more integrated and continuous identification. But what we know so far is that about 18% of suicides are by military veterans. You mentioned drug use. And that's a big factor, too. Studies have shown that about almost 30% of people who die by suicide are intoxicated with alcohol at the time of their death. That's a third of suicides. It's probably one of the few things that accounts for so many people dying by suicide. And so substance use, whether alcohol, now we have problems with opioids, certainly is related to suicidal behavior.
Jill, we've focused on suicide prevention and awareness on a previous show, and we wanted to tweet out a link to that show. We interviewed a woman who lost a family member to suicide. You can find that link on Twitter by searching at Where We Live. But I guess my next question for you is, you know, each time there are high-profile suicide deaths, this conversation happens nationwide. Coincidentally, the two deaths of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain happened the same week that the CDC released this report looking at suicides increasing nationwide. But I'm curious, what are the best ways to talk about suicide when we are members of the media? And, you know, how do we raise awareness as a nation to this problem?
Well, media can play a tremendous role in suicide prevention by talking about stories of survival, talking about stories of resistance, and talking about suicide in a safe way where people can associate with the positive aspects of taking care of yourself. And if you're struggling or really in pain, because that's what happens with people who are suicidal, to encourage people to reach out for help, to let them know where to reach out for help. But also when people are in pain, they're not always able to reach out for help. So the media can work in helping family members to know how to identify when somebody may be at risk and give them tips on what they can do. When the media reports about just the suicide and includes issues around method, most people will be fine, but the person who's at immediate risk can say, hey, that's just like me. And then that might spur them on to act on something they might not otherwise have acted on. So media, positive stories of resilience and survival can make a huge difference, because we do know most people who have been suicidal actually go on to engage in life. They do not die by suicide.
Actually, I wanted to, before we head to break, I did want to ask, you know, for our listeners who may, again, there is that National Suicide Prevention Hotline. If they feel that they need to talk to someone, it's 1-800-273-TALK. But if you know someone, whether it's a friend or a relative, and you worry about them taking their own life, what should they do? Because I, you know, we've heard anecdotally some worry that if they mention, "Are you feeling suicidal?" that that could maybe spur them on to action quicker. I mean, what is the best way to help somebody if they know they're in crisis at the moment?
So that's a great question, and we know from research that if you ask somebody about suicide and use the words, "Are you thinking of suicide? Are you thinking of taking your life?" you will not make them suicidal, because if they are, they are. And also, it's a complex process. But asking about, how are you, what's going on, are you thinking of killing yourself, I'm worried about you and I care about you, can make a big difference. And it actually has a positive effect of reducing suicide risk, just merely asking and listening.
Dr. Jill Harkavy-Friedman, again, is Vice President of Research at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Jill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we're going to switch gears and get an update on the status of a beloved state park after severe storms caused devastating damage to Sleeping Giant in Hamden, also to the town of Hamden. More after the break, and you can join us too, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we're going to hear about a new podcast with the Connecticut Connection. It's called Case Unsolved. It's the creation of New London's newspaper, The Day. That's just ahead. First, it's been almost 1 month since severe storms hit Connecticut and caused devastating damage to properties in several towns. Now, some of that damage was to popular recreation areas, including Sleeping Giant State Park in Hamden. The park has been closed, and we're wanting to find out when it may reopen. For an update on where things stand, I'm joined in studio now by Mike Lambert, Bureau Chief for Outdoor Recreation for the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, known as DEEP. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lucy. It's good to be with you.
So we wanted to focus in on Sleeping Giant. I do know that there was damage to other state parks, but let's talk about Sleeping Giant first. And how severe was that damage from those very severe storms?
Well, damage at Sleeping Giant is severe, as you know. We had large areas of the park impacted by the storms that moved through in mid-May. We have areas of the park specifically around the picnic area and the main visitor parking area, which is an area of about 7 acres, that virtually every tree has been damaged, either uprooted, broken in half, or severe damage in that area. Also, within the picnic area, we have a historic picnic shelter that's that the roof has been damaged, and some of the historic rock work that needs to be repaired and replaced, and some of the other visitor amenities. The restroom facility has roof damage, as well as the picnic tables and grills. So it was a severe storm that severely impacted Sleeping Giant State Park. In addition to the damage, I guess the most obvious damage at the public use areas, there's a number of trees that are down throughout the trail system in the backcountry and the main trail system that goes to the summit. I know through some of our field work, we've identified at least 150 trees that are down on the summit trail. And, you know, we're continuing to assess the backcountry trails and likely going to find more damage in remote areas of the park.
So what has DEEP been doing? So you're obviously assessing the damage, but how many people do you have to try to, you know, get these trees out of the way and to move forward?
So there were a number of parks that have been impacted by the storm in addition to Sleeping Giant. Our staff have been involved with this cleanup effort since day one. I know our staff did yeoman's work at Kettletown State Park in order to make the park available for the Memorial Day weekend. That the timing of the storm is really our busiest time in parks, because we're preparing the park for the official start of our recreation season here in Connecticut. So we've been engaged in cleanup, since the day after the storm. We've been working closely with the Department of Administrative Services in an effort to identify a specialized contractor who can come in and do some of the work that's needed at Sleeping Giant and also Wharton Brook. In addition, we've had an outpouring of support from our friends and volunteers. We've been fortunate at Sleeping Giant to have the longtime support of the Sleeping Giant Park Association. They were formed in 1924 to protect the park, and they manage over 30 miles of trail within Sleeping Giant. So our staff are continuing to assess some of the backcountry trails, and as soon as they're made safe, we're definitely going to call on our volunteers to utilize their expertise and assistance with the cleanup effort in the park.
I wanted to bring into the conversation Hamden's mayor, Kurt Balzano Lang. Again, Sleeping Giant State Park lies in that town, but also Hamden saw significant damage as well. Mayor Lang, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I understand that soon you'll be with Senator Richard Blumenthal as FEMA officials arrive for a preliminary damage assessment. Walk us through that process and how much damage has the town seen?
The process is beginning today in Gusto with FEMA officials actually in town. One team that's going to be reviewing public damage and one that's going to be reviewing private damage on homes and in yards. But it is a lengthy process. We've been into this cleanup now for 3 weeks plus, and I've had the equipment operators and loggers in from out of town because municipalities just don't have the type of equipment that would be necessary to do this type of a cleanup. We had in town 500 plus trees just that were in the right-of-way, street, sidewalk, and 10 feet in of the road that came down mostly in wires, at the time live wires. So we began doing our work immediately to try and open the roads up and make it accessible for our public safety vehicles, and then slowly, methodically cleaning and trimming and cutting and taking trees down. And it's very costly. We've spent well in excess of $1 million already, and that'll be over two before we're done. And so having the FEMA officials in today and having the commitment of both our senators and Congresswoman DeLauro has been really wonderful.
So what are you looking specifically for from FEMA, just dollars to help with the cleanup, and how much are we talking about, Mayor Lang?
So the FEMA process would give 75% reimbursement to eligible costs for town expenses, and that's certainly something that's important to us because we had to borrow these funds. These are not funds that were just laying around. So we had to do an emergency storm account, get the dollars in place, and get to work. But even more important than that at this point, every day that goes by, and certainly every week, we find more and more folks that have been coming out talking about the damage done to their houses and to their yards in the tens and 20s. The highest number I've heard so far for a yard is $75,000 of damage. And we're hoping that FEMA reimbursement process can help the homeowners, not only with the homes, because most or at least a good portion of that damage is covered through insurance. But if you have 20, 25 trees down and a damaged septic system that may or may not be covered by insurance, you need some help.
This is where we live. Today we're getting an update on some of the storm damage seen in the southern part of the state, specifically at Sleeping Giant State Park in Hamden, also in the town of Hamden. On the phone with us is Mayor Kurt Balzano Lang, who's the mayor of Hamden, Connecticut. Also Mike Lambert's in studio with me, Bureau Chief for Outdoor Recreation for the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Mike, in terms of the FEMA officials coming in today, again, for this preliminary damage assessment, how hopeful are you that the state could receive money to help with the cleanup efforts, and how soon could that money come if approved? Do we know?
Well, absolutely. We're hopeful that the FEMA will come in and help reimburse our cost for the cleanup effort. I know in late May we submitted our preliminary damage assessments for Parks and Forest, and this is part of their process where they come out and do the field visit and actually do on-site evaluations of the damage. Typically, the type of work that we're going to be involved in at Sleeping Giant and Wharton Brook, it's a large project, so the FEMA support will come in the form of a reimbursement to our state agency for the cost associated with that. So it would be a tremendous support for us if, you know, we were able to get that support.
Do we know what the costs have been to the state of Connecticut to date? I mean, this is happening near the end of the fiscal year, which is tough.
Yeah, we when we put our preliminary estimates together, which is really, it's a difficult challenge to do that early in the process, we estimated around over $800,000 for the cleanup effort just in our parks and forest. And so it's very expensive.
You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. We heard Mike Lambert talking about the importance of volunteers to the state park system. On the phone right now is Julie, who's calling from North Haven, and I believe she's a member of the Sleeping Giant Parks Association. Julie, what's your question or comment?
Simply to say that we, as a Sleeping Giant Park Association, you know, we've been involved in trail maintenance since the trails were established by groups of volunteers in the early 90s, and our crews go out every week. We are patiently, although perhaps impatiently in some respects, waiting for the go-ahead from the state to be able to go in and assist. I want to thank Mike Lambert for the shout-out to us. We really are passionate about the Giant, and this kind of helps explain our eagerness to get in there and help.
Julie, how many members are part of the association?
The association itself has somewhere around 1,600 members. And recently, through our Facebook page, we've got about 4,000 followers. So people are very passionately interested in what's going on in the park and how they can help. We have a list of over 100 volunteers who don't normally come out with us, but they have expressed an interest to participate as soon as we're given the go-ahead.
Have you ever seen this kind of damage before, Julie?
Oh, gosh, no. This is more than a 100-year event. This is, I think, very unique in the history of the Giant itself.
And in terms of, obviously, there's a lot of cleanup that needs to be done, but concern about the long-term impact of the habitats that these parks provide.
In general, our philosophy is going to be to help clear the trails themselves, to make them accessible and safely passable. But otherwise, the nature will be left to do what Mother Nature does, either repair herself or create new habitats or additional habitats for the creatures, the biodiversity that exists in the park. One area of concern is our invasive species committee, who goes out to try to eradicate those species that come in and take advantage of sort of the opportunity of a cleared space. And we want to monitor that over the next few months and years to make sure that things like the winged euonymus doesn't gain a foothold in the park.
Well, Julie, thank you for calling again. She's a member of the Sleeping Giant Park Association. Also, another call right now is Chuck calling from Watertown. Chuck, go ahead.
Hi. I'm a member of the Sleeping Giant Park Association Trail Crew. I agree 100% with what Julie said. We've had a really good relationship with DEEP. I know they do amazing things with limited manpower and funds. We were kind of surprised when we were told to stay off the trails when the tornado hit. And I just wanted to ask Mike what has to happen before we're going to be allowed to get back to work again. We're kind of twiddling our thumbs here, knowing there's a lot of work to do. And I'd like to ask him what kind of progress is being made in that area.
Thanks, Chuck. Go ahead, Mike Lambert from DEEP.
Well, thank you, Chuck. And first, let me say thank you for all your support. This is someone who's done trail work before. I realized just the significant amount of work that goes into maintaining trails. And when you're dealt a severe storm like this, it only adds to that workload. But we are actively assessing the backcountry trails now. Matter of fact, I spoke with our district supervisor this morning, and they are developing a plan. They have gone out and assessed some of the backcountry trails, ensuring that they are safe to get volunteers on them. And so they're actively developing a plan, and we'll be in touch with the Sleeping Giant Park Association, and hopefully this will be a concerted effort. Our hope is that we have a contractor on the ground in the coming weeks who can assist with some of the major cleanup and some of the visitor use areas. So I see this as a two-pronged approach. You know, we've got staff and volunteer groups working the backcountry trails. We have a specialized contractor who can assist with the major cleanup in the picnic area and the main summit trail. So, you know, our goal is to have the park open as soon as possible. And we appreciate all the support that you've offered us.
So open by the fall?
That's the goal, yeah, as soon as possible. You know, we, you know, unfortunately, I can't give an exact time frame on that, but, you know, with the support we have with the Friends groups and staff and contractor efforts, we're definitely going to work towards that goal.
And before I get back to Hamden Mayor Lang, who's also on the phone with us, just a quick update. So besides Sleeping Giant State Park, there's also one other park that's still closed?
Yes, Wharton Brook State Park in Wallingford is still closed. And there are portions of Kettletown State Park in Southbury. The trails are closed there, as is the group campground.
Are people listening when Deep says this, the parks are closed, or not attempting to go in anyway to see the damage for themselves?
Yeah, they are. That is so important with the nature of this storm and the condition, the way the trees are damaged and uprooted. That is so important that people stay out of these closed areas. We want to get people back there as soon as possible. And so, you know, the patience and allowing the contractors to do their work and the volunteers and the Friends group is going to be paramount.
Again, I mentioned Hamden Mayor Kurt Bolzano-Lang is on the phone with us as well. Any lessons that we can take from this particular storm or the storms that hit that part of the state, Mayor Lang, in terms of disaster preparedness?
You know, I think that there's certainly a few things. One is that, it's going to sound simplistic, but you always have to be prepared. You have to have a family plan. You have to be prepared with equipment if you're going to be out of power for a significant amount of time. You have to think about checking on neighbors and checking on people that are within a community that might not be able to be reached for a while. And that's something that we take for granted nowadays. But one-third of our municipality, and we have 33 square miles, a third of it was completely impassable for 2 days. So we had the fire department, emergency management, actually responding to emergency medical calls via all-terrain vehicles. This was a very unusual situation for modern society. So having your batteries and your water backup, and honestly, taking this storm warning seriously is something else. I think that we all fall into a bit of a lackadaisical scenario because there's so many storm warnings that come across the news so often. But when someone's talking about a tornado or a hurricane or other serious event, we really do have to take it seriously.
And we definitely don't want to diminish the fact that six homes were damaged in the storm in the town of Hamden. What's happened to those residents? Where are they living?
There's some that are living in hotels, some with families, and some that have actually rented apartments already because their insurance company has said it's going to take upwards of 10 months to reconstruct the homes.
And before we head to break, I wanted to go back to Deep's Mike Lambert. I asked Mayor Lang about lessons learned. There have been quite a few storms in the past several years that have caused widespread damage. In terms of how the state could be better prepared for this kind of incident when it happens?
Well, I think part of our efforts with our park operations is we work diligently to identify and remove hazard trees, dangerous limbs in our public use areas. That effort helps in certain situations. It did not help in this case. This was a significant storm event with impacts that really no one could prepare for. But, you know, efforts like that, I think the National Weather Service and our local weather stations do an excellent job of getting the word out. So I think it's important to understand that, you know, outdoor recreation shouldn't be contemplated when, you know, these types of storm events are forecast.
We hear so often about the fiscal situation in the state of Connecticut. Is there a little pot of money when disaster strikes, or do we have to rely on, as you said, we're hearing from the towns about trying to get private contractors and borrowing. What about the state of Connecticut?
So what we've done so far is we've actually utilized our minor maintenance bond funds for this effort. So we're continuing to fund the effort through that. Those funds are utilized to make repairs in parks. Again, we're hopeful that we'll have the FEMA support to seek reimbursement.
Mike Lambert, again, is Bureau Chief for Outdoor Recreation for the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Mike, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
Also on the phone with us is Hamden Mayor Kurt Balzano-Lang. I understand just a few minutes you're going to be heading out to meet the FEMA officials for this preliminary damage assessment. Thank you for joining us on your busy day.
My pleasure. You have a good day.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Up next, have you been listening to Case Unsolved? It's a new crime podcast. It focuses on Connecticut cold cases. We're going to hear more from the staff at New London's newspaper the day they created the podcast. And you can join our conversation, too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up tomorrow, the Affordable Care Act's protections for people with pre-existing conditions is one of the most important provisions in the law, but it may be in jeopardy after a decision by the Department of Justice. We'll find out more about that tomorrow on Where We Live. Now, right now, we wanted to find out, how did you ever live without podcasts? Chores around the house, endless drives to and from work, they're so much nicer now, right? Well, just when you thought you couldn't add another podcast to your playlist, we wanted to draw your attention to a new crime podcast produced by New London's newspaper The Day. Here's a little preview.
Michaud, white female. Cause of death was asphyxia by strangulation. And she was laying on the bed, naked. Cord around her neck.
And our department really wanted to solve this.
It's always stayed with me, right on through all the different ranks that I held and all the different jobs that I did in the police department.
For some places, well, she's just a prostitute. What are you doing spending all that time?
I mean, it's not like this happened even 5 years ago. I mean, this is 1984, you know, 30-some years ago. Let's close this case. You know, that's what I want. And whatever it takes.
That's from Case Unsolved, a podcast from The Day. Joining us now in studio to tell us more is Carlos Virgen, digital news director at The Day, co-producer and narrator of The Day's new podcast. Also Karen Florin, a reporter for The Day. Carlos and Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So let's start with you, Carlos. How did you start to work with the newsroom with people like Karen Florin on this podcast?
Yeah, I think the idea came up late summer of last year, The Day. We'd been producing a couple, at that point, I think three or four podcasts. And so there was interest among editors, many of whom are podcast fans. So they've listened to their favorite podcasts, including true crime podcasts. Our managing editor, Tim Cotter, was a big fan of Crime Town. And he broached the subject with us, and we already had a list of uncased solves that Karen Florin had generated through reporting on the regional cold case unit being disbanded recently in the last couple of years, and kind of dragged in a couple of other people, including a couple of more reporters, and we went from there. Karen started looking through our clips.
So, Karen, you're a longtime reporter with The Day, and Carlos just mentioned there used to be a unit within the state that would look at cold cases. Tell us a little bit about why it was disbanded, and how did you decide on what cold cases to focus on?
So the unit was disbanded, no surprise, due to funding, after having incredible impact. I think in southeastern Connecticut, there were 8 arrests made in cold cases and as many convictions. I was interested in Desiree Michaud because really it was a case I didn't know a lot about. I wanted something new. And we had a lot of lucky breaks there, the first of which was that we had excellent previous reporting on it that gave us a lot of leads to jump into to find people who are still around, who still care, and who wanted to talk about it.
So Desiree Michaud, tell us a little bit about her.
She was just 18. She'd had a terrible upbringing and wound up on the streets of New London working as a prostitute. She also had a very artistic side and was a terrific painter. So at the same time that she was involved in the grittier side of life on the streets, she also got involved in the arts community in New London and was active at the Hygienic, which is it was a restaurant slash gallery, is now a gallery well known for its annual art show.
I understand Desiree was one of many cold cases the state of Connecticut focused on when they came up with using playing cards to try to get tips from people within the Department of Correction. That's really interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I know the Day had reported on that a few years ago.
Sure. It was a great idea of theirs that they would make up a deck of cards with information about each case. Desiree was actually the queen of clubs. The next case that we're doing, William Spicer, he's the King of Hearts. And the third case we're doing, Erica Cerioni, will be the Six of Diamonds. So they made up this deck of cards and distributed it within the prison system. It's the only cards that they have access to and have generated a lot of leads from people who see the cards, realize that there's a reward for providing information, and who come forward after they hear something or if they know something with very valuable information.
Mm. You mentioned that she was murdered when she was just 18. She was working as a prostitute in the city of New London. I wanted to play a clip now from Case Unsolved. In this clip, we're going to hear from retired Groton-town police detectives Mike Lewin and Matt Morton, who talk about Michaud's murder.
And it was a typical motel room that somebody was living in. It wasn't, I'm spending the night and then going over to the seaport, or I'm spending the night going down and see a launching of a sub. It was well lived in, you know, clothes all over, fast food wrappers everywhere.
There was stuff, pile of clothes on the floor. There was a towel here, right? Everything else was neat. There was nothing knocked over. I believe this was a radio, though, with the cord ripped around her neck. Looked like there was I don't know if it was minor or what, stab or puncture wound on her chest. But that apparently that was not the cause of death.
Again, that's a clip from Case Unsolved. It's a new crime podcast produced by New London's newspaper, The Day. In studio with me is Karen Florin, a reporter, also Carlos Virgen, digital news director at The Day and co-producer and narrator of The Day's new podcast. When we listen to the podcast, Carlos, we don't just hear from retired detectives or others in law enforcement, but you actually track down members and friends of these victims. How difficult was that?
Well, one of the main characters in the story turned out to be a former prostitute that knew Desiree during the period that she disappeared and then eventually was found dead. Karen, through her contacts working the court system, was able to amazingly locate her, and amazingly she wanted to be part of the podcast. So that was such a great revelation for the podcast as we started, not knowing how far we could go, not knowing how much participation law enforcement was going to have with us or even her family. That was like the early on in the podcast, mm-hmm. where we knew We're onto something here.
You also tracked down relatives of Desiree, and that was difficult too. After all these years, to see a reporter at their door asking about their daughter, their sister that was killed. What was that like, Karen?
Sure. Carlos and I knocked on the door of Desiree's mother, and she was firm in that she had been through too much trauma and really didn't want to talk about it. And lo and behold, we thought that was a dead end, but she did call up her other daughter, Tina Robb. And Tina, after much convincing, met us out at the cemetery to look for Desiree's grave and then actually gave us some very valuable audio information. So another lucky break that we had.
Carlos, what's the point again of this podcast? Is it to generate tips that these crimes could become solved one day, or is it to focus on the story of people like Desiree who've been forgotten?
Right. I think that our goal from the beginning was to retell the story of these lives and hopefully reach a new audience, reach people outside of our readership. And, you know, some of these, the Desiree case is from 85. So unless you were around in 85 and you've been a subscriber to the day, you most likely are not familiar with Desiree's case. So that was kind of our goal from the beginning, is to retell their stories, hopefully with new information where possible and in a compelling way where we were able to hear the voice of people that knew them when they were alive, and to reach a new audience for sure.
What's been the response?
It's been really good. We've all gotten individually. We've gotten feedback from people we know, people around town, people in our coverage area. We've gotten emails. Where the Desiree case in particular, where people have reached out to us saying, you know, my ex-wife was her teacher in high school. There was a state police officer who contacted us, who was involved in a separate case that Desiree was involved in, and then we've got a Facebook group where people have been really, vocal and asking questions and you know.
Any pushback on why this isn't a print version of the story versus a podcast?
Well, yes, we did actually on theday.com. So we're publishing our podcast through all the regular podcast channels, but also we're developing these stories on theday.com with the audio player. Mm-hmm. And yes, the first episode that we published, there were a number of commenters that were wondering where the print story is and why are we doing a podcast? They don't have time for a podcast. They can read much faster than they can hear, listen to a show. And it was to be expected, I guess. You know, some of our readership, especially our commenters, mm-hmm. are a certain demographic and a certain disposition, I think.
Well, you may get some love from public radio listeners.
Yeah,
they appreciate the podcast.
Yeah, I'm sure. Thank
so this week, the fourth episode is going to roll out. What's your next focus? We heard about Desiree.
So this week's episode is actually a bonus episode on the Desiree Michaud case because of the feedback we've gotten and some of the new information. We when we first produced the three episodes, we had not been able to speak to active law enforcement agents. Since then, we were able to talk to an active detective and a prosecutor, and so we'll add that information, and plus we're going to answer some of the questions that we got through email and on our Facebook page just to clarify some of the information.
And Karen, what will be your involvement?
So I'll be answering questions, and just last week we went out and did those interviews with the detective and the prosecutor. So if I can add any depth to that, I will do my best.
Well, hopefully we've piqued our listeners' interest again to this new crime podcast. I found myself drawn into Desiree's
Great.
Story.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for joining us today to tell us about it. Carlos Vierhen, digital news director at The Day, co-producer and narrator
yes.
of The Day's new podcast. Also, Karen Florin, reporter for The Day. Good to see both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lucy.
Today's show produced by Lydia Brown. Special thanks to Kion Wolf and Carmen Baskoff. Learn more about our show at WMPR.org/where we live. You can download the podcast, too. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. As always, thanks for listening.